It's time for the Nora Firestone Show on Freedom 1110 WKQA. You're invited to be a part of the program by calling 757-222-3705. That's 757-222-3705. Now, with today's program, here is Nora Firestone.
Hi. Well, obviously, I'm not Nora Firestone, but I want to wish you a good afternoon. My name is Drew Nickel. I'm in for Nora Firestone today. She's asked me to step in for her because she was tied up with some other business, and I'm going to be picking up the slack for her just this afternoon. She'll be next week. Nora often says that nothing impacts business like politics does. So I thought we'd talk about politics on a national level in this being an election year, 2016. And I invite you to call in just to tell you a little bit about myself. I have my own blog site at www.drewnickel.com, and that's DrewNickell.com. And I've been read in 55 countries across six continents, and I've got almost 3,000 subscribers, which isn't bad considering I started the website in September of 2015. So I've been blessed with having a lot of subscribers. And Nora is also my acquisitions editor with Keller Books, and I'm coming out with my book sometime in August. It'll be entitled Bending Your Ear, a Collection of Essays on the Issues of Our Time. So I'm very appreciative of Nora and Kohler Books, and I'm looking forward to that as well. But I hope you'll check into my website at www.drewnickel.com, and please register. It's free. It's one of the few things left that's free in this world. But we're going to talk about politics this afternoon, and as you all know, it's an election year, 2016. If you were listening to the Jay Sekulow show a moment ago, he was talking at length about the death of Justice Scalia. I'm sure you've heard by now that Justice Scalia passed away over the weekend, very suddenly, and the headlines have been all about Scalia and President Obama indicating that he would be replacing Justice Scalia. Also, the headlines are out that Justice Scalia's funeral will not be attended by the president. We're not sure exactly why President Obama decided not to go to the funeral, but I understand the weather this weekend in the D.C. area is going to be perfect for golf, so that might be the reason that the president opted out. I'm just kind of shocked by that, because could you imagine if the roles were reversed, if a Republican president said he didn't feel like attending the funeral of a liberal justice? So definite double standard there. But let's think about what has transpired over the weekend. It did not take President Barack Obama a half a dozen sentences to both note the passing of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and to announce that he intends to replace the late justice before his term is out. It's as though the president was chomping at the bit to do so. He seized on the opportunity to leave one last mark, a lasting one at that, on the Supreme Court that has at times thwarted his affinity to rule by fiat through constitutionally questionable executive orders on a host of issues, ranging from immigration to the rights of citizens to bear arms, as guaranteed in the Second Amendment of the Constitution. Justice Scalia, a strict constitutionalist and perhaps the most conservative jurist on the Supreme Court, was widely admired on all sides of the judiciary for his academically sound and scholarly approach to the opinions he authored, both in majority as well as in dissenting opinions. He was the son of Sicilian immigrants, and with his brilliant mind and honest non-political approach towards the execution of his duties on the high court, he will be sorely missed by all but one. And that one who will not miss him is none other than President of the United States, Barack Obama, who has heretofore shown much contempt for the bothersome document that seems to get in his way, the Constitution of the United States, which Justice Scalia held in very high regard. It has been reported that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Republican of Kentucky, and Senate Judiciary Chairman Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, have indicated their intent to delay hearings on Scalia's replacement until after the 2016 presidential election. There's been some backtracking on that since that initial report, but standing on a tradition that has been in place for the last 8 decades, where Supreme Court nominations have been set aside during presidential election years, it is altogether fitting that the Republican leadership in the Senate takes such a stance. Certainly, there is no doubt that if the situation were reversed, Democrats in the Senate would do precisely the same thing. In fact, they did the same thing back in 2007, a full year before the 2008 election, when the Democrat-led Senate delayed judicial appointments proffered by President George W. Bush at the time. It's interesting that Democrats today are saying we need to rush ahead with this nomination when just a few years back they took the opposite approach. The question is whether or not the Senate leadership will hold firm in their resistance to a political onslaught that is sure to follow, with Democrats, their candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and the mainstream media all at the ready to charge the Republicans with obstructionism or worse. For instance, all President Obama has to do is to put forward the nomination of an African American on the high court, and charges of racism will surely follow any Republican resistance to the nominee, regardless of the candidate's qualifications or lack thereof. The same holds true for any woman of any color, where the resistance will fire up Hillary Clinton's mantra of the supposed Republican war on women, or some such rot. Given that temptation, Obama will likely proffer an African-American woman, such as Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and dare the Republicans to stand in his way, especially since her own confirmation as Attorney General was approved 56-43 in a Senate vote last year. I would say that it's odds-on favorite that Loretta Lynch will be the next nominee, but we'll see about that. In any event, there is much at stake for the Republican leadership should they cave into pressure from Democrats on the major media to proceed with hearings and eventual consent of Obama's nominee, for they have already had the reputation of acceding to the demands of this imperial president on issues ranging from the budget to the dubious Iran deal, thanks to the ridiculous finaglings of Senator Bob Corker, who made it much easier for that bad Iran deal to sail through the Senate. Even more so, the overall direction of the Supreme Court, given the absence of Scalia, already teeters on upcoming rulings regarding Obama's use of executive orders to bypass Congress, and this court hazardously remains in flux. It's just going to take one more liberal justice to sway the court for an entire generation. And for that entire generation, the concept of legislative power and the rule of law can be kissed goodbye if Obama gets one more pick on the Supreme Court. Now, all of this lends credence to just how important the election of 2016 has become, and for reasons that continue to pop up at such an alarming rate to boot. Now, if you'd like to discuss this and other issues, I hope you'll call in at 757-222-3705. That's 757-222-3705. And this is WKQA Freedom 110 on your AM dial. Now, let's talk about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is an integral part of the balance of government. And when the framers of the Constitution set up the Supreme Court, they set it up as to three equal branches. You had an executive branch, the President of the United States. You have a legislative branch, which is the Congress and the Senate. And you have the Supreme Court, the judicial branch. Each of those elements is designed to carry out specific parts of the law, because we are a nation of laws. It's up to the legislature to pass the laws. It's up to the president to enforce the laws and administer the laws. And it's up to the Supreme Court to rule on the constitutionality of these laws. Too often in the past decades, the Supreme Court has often taken it upon itself to legislate from the bench, but that was not the intent of the founding documents. Theirs is a role of referee, if you will, but they're not supposed to be passing laws themselves. And that is the difference between an activist justice, such as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and a constitutionalist justice, like the late Justice Scalia. Incidentally, those two were best friends. Justice Bader Ginsburg often referred to Scalia as her buddy, which just goes to show when people are of goodwill, they can work together. And that's surprising given this day where there is so much acrimony in Washington, D.C. Now, let's think about the presidential election. Like many of you, I haven't made up my mind who I'm voting for. I have closed in on one of the three front runners, but I haven't made up my mind amongst any of them. But I will say this up front, and I'm not going to make any bones about where I stand politically. I think any of the six, in fact, I'll go on to say, any of the original 17 candidates, if you can believe there are that many, I think they would do a far better job for this country than either of the Democrats running for office. Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, either one of them, I think, would be far worse, especially given the state of the world and where this country is at this point in time, than any of the Republicans that had been running or are still in the running. Now, what the principal issue of this campaign, and we hear a lot about ISIS, we hear a lot about the Middle East, we hear a lot about terrorism, we hear a lot about the economy, we hear lately about the Supreme Court, but there's one issue above all others that is coming down to in this election. And that is, does this country want to be a country made of opportunity, or does this country want to be yet another socialist failure in the grand scheme of things? This is an important question because the biggest issue facing the Republicans is not who's going to beat Donald Trump. The biggest issue of the facing the Republicans is who is strong enough to defeat Hillary Clinton in the fall. Now, we can look at, we'll start at the bottom, for instance. We'll look at Ben Carson. We look at Jeb Bush. We look at John Kasich. All of these men are very fine men. Any one of them would make a fine president. But the issue is, how can they win? And the worst thing Republicans can do is to nominate yet another moderate, go along, get along with mainstream, middle-of-the-road Republican, because they're in for a fight this fall. And anyone who thinks that Hillary Clinton is not a savage debater better wake up and smell the roses. What it's going to take for the Republicans to win is a fighter. It has to be a fighter, because Hillary Clinton is going to pull out all the stops. And if we have a repeat of recent elections where we had oh-so-moderate John McCain or oh-so-gentlemanly Mitt Romney facing Hillary Clinton on a debate stage, Hillary Clinton is going to wipe up the floor with them, because she is combative and she does not hold back. And the time for being a gentleman is going to end at that debate when they face Hillary Clinton. Now, I know a lot of you out there are thinking, well, maybe Bernie Sanders will take the nomination. If Bernie Sanders gets the nomination, that is going to be a dream for any conservative and Republican, because there is no way this country is going to elect a 74-year-old socialist, especially one who will, if elected, will try to put in policies that will bring down the very strength of this country. This is not a socialist country. We will never be a socialist country as long as we hold true to our values. This country was built on initiative, drive, and personal independence. If you depend on government for everything, then you're a slave to them always. Now, interestingly enough about this election is the Trump phenomenon. You know, I don't know exactly what to think about Donald Trump other than this. I think he's a creature of our times, and let me explain that. You've got to hand it to the Donald. No one in a generation or two, perhaps even going back to FDR in the 1930s, has mastered the art of media manipulation the way that Donald Trump has done, and with such little effort. Be it the wall he wants to build, or the temporary ban on Muslims immigrating into this country, or multiple slams against members of the media and his own political opponents in both parties. Every time the man says something that no one else has the, forgive the term, cojones to say, the media goes into a hissy fit, and his poll numbers rise and rise and rise again. Such a phenomenon is making even the most arrogant media pundits scratch their collective heads and wonder in bewilderment how this can happen in an America whose thought processes were once believed to be under their strict and presumptive control. The short answer is, they just don't get it. And when I say they, I'm meaning the Obama administration, the Democratic National Committee, the Democrat candidates for president, the Republican National Committee, and most of the Republican candidates for president, both the Republican and Democrat leadership in the U.S. Senate and House, and most of the major media, including Fox News, who are all screaming about Donald Trump's latest proposal to delay Muslim immigration temporarily until we can improve our procedures for screening Muslim immigrants and visitors alike. Now, I'm not advocating for Donald Trump. What I'm trying to explain is why he is so popular and what it is about Donald Trump that has excited this race to a degree that hasn't been so before. Now, this can only mean one thing. All of these powers that be that don't get it about Donald Trump, they're all deathly afraid that the man can win the Republican nomination and win the election. And here's what they don't seem to get. Often, in the course of our history, Americans have elected a president as the direct result of and an absolutely polar opposition to his immediate predecessor. For instance, in 1920, Americans were fed up with Woodrow Wilson's internationalism and realizing the futility of our entry into Europe's Great War, this country elected a Republican isolationist, one Warren G. Harding, who ran on a simple platform of returning this nation to normalcy. While the term was coined at the time and never really defined, Americans knew what he meant by normalcy, and he was swept into the White House by a substantial margin. In 1932, Americans were fed up with Republican Herbert Hoover's laissez-faire approach to the Great Depression and elected a president who promised a New Deal, one Franklin D. Roosevelt, despite the warnings that much of FDR advocated with socialism bordering on communism. Now, we're going to continue to look at this issue of history and how it affects the Trump phenomenon after our break. Remember to call in to 757-222-3705. This is the Nora Firestone Show.
Nora will be right back here on Freedom 1110 WKQA. Nora Firestone, she's way smarter than Hillary, and she'll charge a lot less than $675,000 to speak to your group or organization. Check out her professional business insights designed to educate, equip, and empower you. Thursdays at 1, here on Freedom 1110 WKQA. Caution, the Nora Firestone Show may be laced with anti-socialist rants, constitutionalist principles, and more common sense than a left brain can process. Welcome back to the Nora Firestone Show here on Freedom 1110 WKQA. Now, here's Nora.
Hi, this is Drew Nickel, and thank you for tuning in this afternoon. I'm sitting in for Nora, and we're discussing national politics. If you'd like to call in on 757-222-3705. This is WKQA Freedom 1110 on your AM dial. So we hope you'll call in. What we were discussing before the break, we were discussing the history of the presidency of the United States and how often it happens that we tend to elect opposites following the terms of our presidents. We had gotten up to 1932, where Americans were fed up with Republican Herbert Hoover's laissez-faire approach to the Great Depression, and we elected a progressive Democrat who promised a New Deal, one Franklin Delano Roosevelt, despite warnings that much of what FDR advocated was socialism bordering on communism. In 1952, Americans were fed up with Democrat Harry Truman and his police action taking place in Korea, which was costing tens of thousands of American lives with little to show for it. And we elected a Republican non-politician, one Dwight David Eisenhower, who promised to go to Korea and end the stalemate. 8 years later, in 1960s, Americans were fed up with the bland and blasé Republican Eisenhower administrated and elected a Democrat with movie star good looks who promised to get America moving again, one John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who spoke of a new frontier, which sounded exciting as America entered into the 1960s. In 1968, Americans were again fed up with the Democrats' JFK-LBJ war in Vietnam and its domestic backlash here at home, and elected a Republican, Richard Milhouse Nixon, who supposedly spoke for the great silent majority of Americans who wanted this country to return to a time and place where such upheaval did not exist. Fast forward to 1976. Americans were again fed up with Nixonian corruption and Republican Gerald Ford's pardon of his predecessor, and summarily elected one unknown Democrat, Governor Jimmy Carter of Georgia, who ran on something as simple as promising to tell the truth. In 1980, Americans were tired of the effectlessness and incompetence of Jimmy Carter's lack of effective response to the Iranian revolutionaries who had kidnapped American hostages, and elected Republican Ronald Reagan, who ran on a platform touting a new beginning for America. His successor in 1992, George Bush, was turned out of office by a combination of baby boomers who sought the election of one of their own, aided and abetted by a third party run by George H.W. Bush's nemesis, H. Ross Perot, and that is how Bill Clinton got elected. In 2000, Americans were fed up with the corruption in the Clinton White House and wary of Clinton's womanizing ways, and elected Republican George W. Bush, a born-again religious man whose marriage and family life more equated the values of middle America. In 2008, Americans were fed up with the Republican Bush's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and with the help of an adoring media who failed to properly vet the unknown outsider, elected Democrat Barack Obama President of the United States. Now, in 2016, America finds itself fed up with Barack Obama and his assistants' insistence that radical Islam is not a problem associated with terrorism. Think about that. He insists that the terrorism that we see over in the Middle East has nothing to do with radical Islam. Nor does he recognize that radical Islam is associated with the terrorism here in the United States and across much of the world. Americans are fed up with a politically correct mantra of not offending anyone, be they illegal immigrants from Mexico or radical Muslims coming here from the Middle East, when most Americans know, even in their own silence, for fear of being labeled a bigot, that open borders and the lack of proper screening of Muslim refugees from Syria and other parts of the Middle East pose the potential for great peril and our own national security. And into this world and into this void enters a candidate who is not afraid to say what many Americans, admittedly or not, are thinking. We need to seal our borders, and we need to arrive upon the means by which we can better screen immigrants from countries and cultures who wish us harm. One, Donald Trump. Now, Donald Trump is nothing if not a man of the times in which he exists. And the all-American antidote to a feckless and cowardly apologist for Islamic extremism, one Barack Hussein Obama. He is, or seems to be, to Obama what Harding was to Wilson, what FDR was to Hoover, what Eisenhower was to Truman, what Kennedy was to Eisenhower, what Nixon was to JFK and LBJ, what Carter was to Nixon and Ford, what Reagan was to Carter, what Bill Clinton was to the elder Bush, what the younger Bush was to Clinton, and to what Obama himself was once to the younger Bush, and yet they still don't get Donald Trump. Now, I don't know if Donald Trump would be a good president or not. I don't know if Donald Trump is a conservative or a liberal. But this much I do know. Donald Trump has the presence, he has the personality to say what he thinks. He's not afraid to say what he thinks, and he is doing that on his own dime. And this would be the first candidate that ran for president on his own dime, probably going back to George Washington. And that in and of itself is a refreshing note, if you will, because money is played far too much in the politics of this nation. And Donald Trump will be beholden to no one. Now, there is a question, what kind of a president would he be? And in that mix, I'm going to also throw out two other names. And it's interesting because the Republicans, supposedly the all-white, all-male Republicans, feature not one but two Cuban Americans running for the same office, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. If elected, either one of them would be the first Hispanic president of the United States. But we don't hear too much about that. In fact, some people have the temerity to say that Ted Cruz is not a real Cuban. Well, Ted Cruz was born in Canada to an American mother, and let's settle this once for all. The fact that he was born to an American mother makes him a citizen of the United States. So all this talk about Cruz not being qualified to be president of the United States is nothing but a bunch of bunk put forth by people who don't want to see him elected. Now, if you look at Trump with his brash personality, he has that American first. He has that attitude, say, of a Theodore Roosevelt. Get out of my way. I'm coming in. I'm going to fix what's wrong. And that's a good thing, especially given the fact that we've had a president of the United States for the last 7 years that has the spine of a jellyfish. We'll set that aside for a minute. Then you look at Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio is a very smart man. He is a very well-spoken man. He's very glib on the stump. He often reminds me in his speaking style of a Ronald Reagan or a John F. Kennedy, because he can put into words in a very smooth delivery, and he's very charismatic. Those are plus things as well. When you're talking about ideology, I don't think anybody can hold a candle to Ted Cruz, because Ted Cruz is probably the most consistently conservative president, presidential candidate, that is running for office. So this is why I'm in a quandary. Do I want a Ted Cruz who is ideologically pure? Do I want a Marco Rubio who is charismatic and well-spoken? Do I want a Donald Trump, no-holds-barred type of guy? I will say this much. If you look at the other three candidates, they're good men. Jeb Bush, John Kasich, Ben Carson. But they're so mellow and so laid back, they're not capable of defeating Hillary Clinton. And as I said before, that is the central issue of this campaign. How do we keep Hillary Clinton out of the White House? Because let's face it, Hillary Clinton has had legal issues going back 40 years. It started when she was the only lawyer on the Watergate subcommittee who was sent out of her position. She was fired from the Watergate Commission for ethics violations. This was in 1974. Look at her record since then. All of Bill Clinton's shenanigans with women. Hillary was the attack dog that went after these women. And the irony is this. Hillary runs as this pro-woman, I've got your back, I'm going to protect women. And what does she do every time a woman comes forward with an accusation against Bill Clinton? What does she do? She goes after the woman. She sicks her attack dogs on her. Why is this? There's only one reason. Politics. If you look at Hillary Clinton during her husband's term of office as president of the United States, consistently, she was putting forth the idea that she was a co-president. She came up with Hillary Care. I remember this about Hillary Care. They did a diagram, it was published in all the newspapers at the time, of what Hillary Care looked like. And it had all of these different boxes flowing like tentacles into a central core. And that central core was the White House. Hillary Care was all about the White House controlling our medicine, our medical services, our doctors. And Hillary Care didn't hold a candle to Obamacare. For the first time in U.S. history, we are now required to buy a product, whether it's gotten through our employers or we have to go on the open market under Obamacare. We're required to purchase a product. That has never happened in the history of this country. Healthcare is a need. Healthcare is a necessity. But there's nothing in the Constitution of the United States that indicates that healthcare is a right. And we should guard against any effort to make anything along that line a guaranteed right. Why? Because the more government gives, the less freedom we have. It's axiomatic. That's the problem I have with both of the candidates. Listen to Bernie Sanders. He wants free health care for everybody. He wants free college education for everybody. Free, free, free. Let me tell you something. I've been in business for 40 years. I've been studying politics since I was the age of 10. It was my hobby as a kid. I was a very real weird kid. But the point I'm trying to make is, every time somebody from the government uses the word free, grab your wallet because they're coming for it. And let me tell you something. Healthcare will never be as expensive in this country as it will be under a Bernie Sanders guarantee of free healthcare for everyone, because you're going to pay for it. You're going to pay for it big time. Your taxes are going to go up. And I'm not talking about the 1%. I'm talking about everybody. You don't get free college tuition. You don't get free health care. And you don't get the rest of these freebies without paying for it through your tax dollars. And we as a nation are already overtaxed substantially. I'm a middle class person. I don't make big money. And yet the taxes I pay in terms of federal, state, local, Medicare, we'll go ahead and throw in Social Security, sales taxes. I added it up. 60% of every dollar I earn goes to the government one way or the other. That only leaves me 40% to pay for my house, my food, my cable television, because I like to see the Baltimore Ravens, and occasionally going out to a karaoke club. That's not what I call a luxurious lifestyle. But if Bernie Sanders gets elected, or if Hillary Clinton gets elected, our taxes are going to go up to the point where all of us are going to be equally miserable and equally poor. And that's my definition of socialism. Socialism is a device to make all of us equally miserable and equally poor, that only the powers that be will have the wealth. And it's theft. If I take money from person A and give it by force to person B, that's not charity. When money is taken from one person and given to another through force, through law, that's theft. I'm all for charity. I think we should all be charitable. We're all called upon to be charitable. But at the end of the day, if the government forces you to give up some of your money and give it to somebody else, that is not charity. That is theft. And that is why I cannot see any situation where this country would benefit from the election of either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, because their election would finish off the job that Obama has started, the destruction of this country as we know it today. So now we're going to take another break, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
Nora will be right back here on Freedom 1110 WKQA. Nora Firestone. She's way smarter than Hillary, and she'll charge a lot less than $675,000 to speak to your group or organization. Check out her professional business insights designed to educate, equip, and empower you. Thursdays at 1, here on Freedom 1110 WKQA. Caution, the Nora Firestone Show may be laced with anti-socialist rants, constitutionalist principles, and more common sense than a left brain can process. Welcome back to the Nora Firestone Show here on Freedom 1110 WKQA. Now, here's Nora.
Hi, this is Drew Nickel again, sitting in for Nora Firestone, and I hope you'll register on my website, www.drewnickel.com. That's DREWNICKELL. That extra L is for inflation, because as we all know, a nickel isn't what it used to be. But www.drewnickel.com. And remember, Kohler Books, for whom Nora is an acquisition editor, is going to be releasing my book sometime late summer, called Bending Your Ear, a collection of essays on the issues of our times. And you'll see a lot of these essays on my website at www.drewnickel.com. We're on WKQA Freedom 1110 on your AM dial. We hope you call in at 757-222-3705. You know, you think about this age of information that we're living in, this so-called information age, and given all of the various sources from which one can attain related information, one might be tempted to come to the erroneous conclusion that people today are better informed about politics in general and presidential candidacies specifically than ever before. With the sheer number of intramural debates being televised in this election year, one might be tempted to come to an equally erroneous conclusion that people today are better able to select the best candidates to support their respective parties' nominations. As much as we would love to believe both of these to be true, sadly, we suspect quite the opposite. A major part of the problem are the debates themselves. One look on the most recent Democrat and Republican debates reveals much as to why there is so much dysfunction in the selection of presidential nominees. The fix would be quite easy, but as usual, the powers to be will sadly never go for it, much to the disservice of the American citizenry. On the Democrat side, Thursday night's debate in Milwaukee offered more acrimony between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders than we've seen to date. Yet this encounter revealed little, if anything, to sway their Democrat constituents one way or another. Why? Because the PBS debate moderators, Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff, offered softball questions to frontrunner Hillary Clinton and utterly failed to ask the former First Lady the most important question concerning her own campaign. And that question, which should have been asked, is this: how do you, Mrs. Clinton, expect to gain the trust of the American people when you, your underlings at the State Department, and people associated with the Clinton Foundation are all under criminal investigation by the FBI? Conversely, on the Republican side, Saturday night's debate in Greenville, South Carolina, approached a food fight instigated by the late John Belushi's character, Blutarski, in the iconic motion picture comedy Animal House. Ironically, it was John Belushi's character, as he portrayed it in the movie, that ends up being a U.S. senator in the closing scene of the movie. How ironic is that? But the three stooges in the debate, Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, and I'll go ahead and throw in Marco also, spent much of the evening hurling insults back and forth in a three-way pie-throwing contest, largely because the CBS News debate moderated by John Dickerson and Major Garrick, along with Kimberly Stossel of the Wall Street Journal, failed miserably to maintain control of what initially began as a substantive debate on the issues. For their own part, the remaining three candidates, Ben Carson, John Kasich, and Marco Rubio, were each able to maintain their respective composures by wisely staying out of the free-for-all between Bush, Cruz, and Trump. Yet their messages were largely overshadowed by the acrimony on display that night. Adversely affecting both the Democrat and the Republican debates and how they are moderated is the presence of a live audience whose raucous behavior, cheering, booing, and taking sides only serves to inflame the acrimony, encourage the childishness, and ultimately waste valuable time, things that are most unhelpful in the selection of the next president. if the debates going forward were to return to the format of the 1960 Kennedy-Nixon debates, which were televised in a studio set apart from a live audience, a more substantive and informative debate, one which would better serve the American people in their selection of the next president, might be possible. Then again, when all of the networks, ABC, CBS, CNBC, CNN, Fox Business News, the Fox News Network, MSNBC, NBC itself, and PBS, when all of these networks view the debates in the paltry prism of ratings and money, why should the public entrust these enterprises with something as prescient and something as important as the selection of the next president? Why indeed? This is something we need to think about. And I want you to think about that in the context of, you may be a Democrat that has voted Democratic all your life. You might be a Republican that has voted Republican all your life. But the time for partisan politics is past, when this country faces so much danger, both at home and from abroad. Americans are becoming more and more divided along racial, economic, religious, and philosophical classes. This has gotten worse in these last 8 years because, to be frank, Barack Obama is the most divisive president we have ever had in the history of this country. He has driven the whole Black Lives Matter movement, where policemen are being targeted by protesters who went through, they didn't go through the pains of civil rights legislation and equality, fighting for equality that their parents and grandparents went through. These kids have never experienced that kind of discrimination, but they're taking to the streets and attacking police officers. If I were a policeman, I'd stay in my squad car because I'd be afraid to get out of it for fear of what might happen to me. And that's a sad day when we're a country of laws and not a country of mob rule. And that's what we have often become in our major cities. My parents were from Baltimore. Look what's happened to that great American city. And as I understand it, the instigator behind the Black Lives Matter protest, the one who was encouraging all of the violence last year in Baltimore, he's running for mayor. And Obama is having a sit-down with him to go over his campaign. Instead of going to a funeral for the justice who has passed away, who served this country for 30 years, Obama's spending his time encouraging the candidacies of a riot maker, a mob rule guy who's running for mayor of Baltimore. I'm going to tell you what we need, and I want you to think about this in terms of where this country is headed. July 4th, 2016 will mark the 240th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia. To commemorate America's birthday, there will be the customary parades and firework displays and barbecues and picnics all across the land, just as there should be. Americans, the true Americans who are not swept up in the anti-Americanism that seems to be the cause célèbre du jour that has taken hold of many on the left, will no doubt celebrate America's birthday and all for which it has stood and still stands today. This is the Independence Day most of us revere and which most of us are familiar. However, there is a grievous need for another type of Independence Day, a true Independence Day, the type of Independence Day which will reaffirm all that has made us independent and thereby has guaranteed the freedoms that we all too often take for granted. In essence, we need an Independence Day which will revive the slumbering spirit of independence before we finally lose this spirit. The spirit of independence has little to do with government largesse. In fact, it is this same sense of governmental largesse that has come to threaten our very freedoms and sense of independence as we know it. This spirit of independence is thwarted by demands for welfare and transition to a welfare state. This spirit of independence evaporates with every new user added to the growing rolls of public assistance, EBT, extended unemployment benefits, pre-retirement Social Security distributions attributable to a growing and specious disability payments, aid for dependent mothers, and other such programs, all of which have grown exponentially in the last decade. For every person thus put on the public dole, there is one less person who is independent, and one more person who, albeit unintentionally, weakens our nation. This spirit of independence that I'm talking about is threatened by a growing clarion calls for universal, cradle-to-grave health care. That means government-provided health care. As though good health were something that should not only be guaranteed as a right, but provided for by right, when such ideology does more than anything else to increase the burden on health care providers and take ever more earnings from those who still work for a living by transferring their wealth to those who refuse to work for a living. This spirit of independence is under attack by those who favor open borders, to those who believe that suffrage, which is the right to vote, should be extended to non-citizens who increase dependency on social programs, the cost of which is already spinning well out of control. The cost of uncontrolled and illegal immigration, when measured in terms of crimes being perpetrated by many entering illegal through our poor southern borders, are enormous and exponentially growing year by year. This spirit of independence is assaulted by those who believe that post-high school education should be free, meaning that it should be paid for by increased corporate taxation, despite the very fact that the United States already has the very highest corporate tax rate in the entire world. The strange that this ideology places upon those who pay their own tuition and those who must borrow money to pay for their own tuition does more than anything else to astronomically increase the cost of education to ridiculously high levels. These costs are increasing at such an alarming rate that we are quickly approaching the day when we will see the margins of diminishing return apply to the demand for college education. In essence, a college education will be deemed not worthy of the costs associated with acquiring that college education. It has been said that a nation in which people depend upon government for everything is a nation of servants. That to depend upon government for everything will produce a system where the people are subject to the loss of personal freedom. In essence, we become enslaved to our own masters in government, who would seek to control all aspects of our lives in exchange for the largesse they provide. This dependence is not that upon which our forefathers risked their lives, their property, and their sacred honor, as stated in the Declaration of Independence. They did not fight a war with Great Britain to create a nation of suckling pigs, permanently attached to the teats of a massive sow that is government largesse. No, these patriots were the very expression of self-sufficiency and independence that once made this nation the greatest nation in the world. And now, those very things that made us so strong and independent are threatened to the point of extinction by an ever-increasing dependence on the state for everything we want, determined to our entitlement. So coming up this 4th of July, on the 240th anniversary of American independence, let us resolve to reincarnate a spirit of true independence. Let us endeavor to revive the spirit of self-sufficiency and reacquire the can-do determination to make for ourselves a more perfect union without having to depend upon someone else to do this for us. Let us as a nation once again project a righteous indignation to persevere on without having to depend upon a state that would seek to further enslave and constrain our desire to pursue our birthright for this day and for all time. I want you to be thinking about that when you're deciding what kind of country you want to have. Do you want to have the kind of country that was so strong that we led the world in the Industrial Revolution, that we led the world in innovation? Or do you want us to become yet another failed socialist state? One in which the burdens of providing everything to everyone bring down the strength of this country. Because let's face it, folks, a world without an America, strong as she is a world that is going to see death and destruction, because there's not going to be anybody to protect the rest of the world from the things that are threatening all of us. You know, you can say, if you're a Democrat or a liberal, that global climate change is the most threatening thing to America. Far and away, that's not even proven as far as science is concerned. There's a lot of debate on that, but I can tell you this. I'm more afraid of somebody cutting off my head because I don't worship Allah the way they do than worrying about whether or not the climate is going to increase by 1 degree in the next 100 years. I hope that you will keep these things in mind when you decide who to vote for next fall. It's been my pleasure to fill in for Nora Firestone. I want to thank her and the staff of WKQA for inviting me to bend your ear for this last hour. Register on my website at www.drewnickel.com and be looking for the publication of my books coming out from Keller Books in August, Bending Your Ear, a collection of essays on the issues of our times. To all of you out there and to all of you who are following me on my website and who are listening to WKQA Freedom 1110 AM, I wish you all of the best. But remember this, your right to run your government is a sacred right. Don't let it go easily, and don't fall for shenanigans by those who promise everything and deliver nothing.